My own teacher, Ling Rinpoche, remained in the clear light of death for 13 days. Although he was clinically dead and had stopped breathing, he stayed in the meditation posture and his body showed no signs of decomposition. Another realized meditator remained in this state for 17 days in the tropical heat of high summer in eastern India. It would be most interesting to know what was happening at the physiological level during this period, and if there might be any detectable signs at the biochemical level. When Richard Davidson's team came to Dharamsala, they were keen to do some experiments on this phenomenon. But when they were there, I'm not sure whether I should say fortunately or unfortunately, no meditators died. However, from the perspective of contributing to the emergence of a scientific method grounded in a rigorous first-person approach, these types of practice are not strictly relevant. In training ourselves to take consciousness itself as the object of first-person investigation, we must first stabilize the mind. The experience of attending to the mere present is a very helpful practice. The focus of this practice is a sustained training to cultivate the ability to hold the mind undistractedly on the immediate, subjective experience of consciousness. This is done as follows. Before one begins formal sitting meditation, one develops a deliberate intention not to allow the mind to be distracted either by recollections of past experience or by hopes, anticipations, and fears about future events. This is done by making a silent pledge that during this meditation session, the mind will not be seduced by thoughts of the past or the future, and that it will remain fully focused on awareness of the present. This is critical because in our everyday normal states, we tend to be tied either to recollections and vestiges of the past or to hopes and fears about the future. We tend to live either in the past or in the future and very rarely fully in the present. When one is actually in the meditation session, it may be helpful to face a wall that has no contrasting colors or patterns that may distract the attention. A muted color like beige or cream can be suitable, for these help create a simple background. When one is actually in the session, it is critical not to apply any exertion. Rather, one must simply observe the mind resting naturally in its own state. As one sits, one will begin to notice that all sorts of thoughts arise in the mind, like a bubbling spring of never-ending internal chatter or the bustling of endless traffic. One should allow whatever thoughts arise to do so freely, regardless of whether one perceives them as wholesome or unwholesome. Do not reinforce them or repress them or subject them to evaluative judgment. Any of these responses will create further proliferation of thought, for it will provide the fuel that keeps the chain reaction going. One must simply observe the thoughts. When one does this, just as bubbles arise and dissolve into water, the discursive thought processes simply arise and dissolve within the mind. Gradually, in the midst of the internal chatter, one will begin to glimpse what feels like a mere absence, a state of mind with no specific determinable content. At the beginning, such states may be only fleeting experiences. Nevertheless, as one becomes more experienced in this practice, one will be able to prolong the intervals in one's normal proliferation of thought. Once this happens, there is a real opportunity to understand experientially what is described in the Buddhist definition of consciousness as luminous and knowing. In this way, a meditator will gradually be able to grasp the basic experience of consciousness and take that as the object of meditative investigation. Consciousness is a very elusive object, and in this sense, it is quite unlike the focus on a material object such as biochemical processes. Yet its elusiveness may be compared with that of some objects of physics and biology, like subatomic particles or genes. Now that the methods and protocols for their investigation are fully established, these things seem familiar and even relatively uncontentious. All these studies are observation-driven, in that, regardless of the philosophical views scientists may bring to any given experiment, in the final analysis, it is the empirical observation based on evidence and the discovery of phenomena that must determine what is true. Likewise, whatever our philosophical views about the nature of consciousness, whether it is ultimately material or not, through a rigorous first-person method, we can learn to observe the phenomena, including their characteristics and causal dynamics.